The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first three meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, December 6th, 2016. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The consequences of seeing yourself on TV, the consequences when you don't. Are the media around you a reflection of your community or an imposition from the outside of your own experiences? That's our focus this hour, and we begin with some tightly focused images. Are the cops on your side or not? And if they are, how can we evaluate their actions? In many cases, we can peer through the window of newly available web cameras and auto dash cams to see what happens at the time of a police shooting. There's also the window of history, fears we carry, aggressions we cling to. A mistrial was declared yesterday in the police shooting death of Walter Scott, whose shooting and subsequent death was captured on both cell phone and dash camera footage as he ran from an officer following a traffic stop for a non-working taillight. Michael Slager, a white North Charleston police officer, is seen shooting Scott, who is African-American, firing multiple rounds from behind while pursuing him. Slager testified in the trial that he was in total fear of his life. Jurors were dismissed over the weekend, with all but one juror believing Slager was guilty. Deliberations continued most of the day Monday before the judge declared a mistrial. The panel's only black member, the jury's foreman, said there was just one juror with issues. Phil Stinson is a former police officer and currently an associate professor of criminology at Bowling Green State University's criminal justice program, where he collects data on police-related shootings. A jury, he says, is also an imperfect window for seeing how a community applies its standards in cases like these.
When I looked at this video, the first time I saw this video of this shooting, I was really shocked, frankly, because what we have there is Walter Scott running away from the officer, and with his back to the officer shoots him dead. It was an execution. It was not justified, in my opinion. And then, even more shocking, the officer's very first reaction, the very first thing he did was to run back and get his taser, which is about 60 feet away on the ground, and place it next to the fallen man's body. In other words, he planted evidence. And we've known for a long time that some dirty cops plant evidence, that that happens, but we've never seen it on video before. And it's really troubling. It's really troubling, and it's a view into the police subculture that the general public doesn't often see.
Well, that's what's so puzzling about this case. I mean, I'm looking through that window just like you are. I'm shocked just like you are. I'm feeling as though my safety as a citizen is compromised by the idea that someone who in one moment says, I'm fearing for my life, and the next moment is like covering up evidence, right, that it's all a bunch of baloney. Why did they walk free? Why did they walk free?
Well, you know, I ask myself this question every day, and one of the things that I keep coming back to, I wonder if frankly they're overcharging the officers. In other words, it would be a lot easier to prove negligence if they had just gone with that, if they had gone with a lesser degree of homicide, so a manslaughter charge from the beginning. Another thing they could do is there's a charge, it's an odd name, but it's called felony murder, and that's when someone commits a killing during the act of some felony. And we've seen that specifically in the state of Georgia. They seem to use that more often in these police shooting cases, and it's resulted in getting convictions more often than not. And so it's a tough thing, but the prosecutor has to, in any case, make sure that they can prove the elements of the crime or crimes that they charge. And we're seeing it over and over again. They're just not going to be able to make murder cases out in the most egregious of situations, the most shocking of situations, as we have here in the video we all saw with Michael Slager.
Does the prosecution have a choice of whether to retry this or not?
Oh, absolutely. And they are going to retry it. But more importantly than that, you know, there are some other avenues that can be taken and are being taken in this case. So there are statutes that are federal criminal deprivation of civil rights laws, so 18 U.S.C. 242. And under that, historically, what that's been used for is when a state has failed to prosecute or failed to successfully prosecute a police officer, they come in after that and try an officer. And that's what we saw in the Rodney King case, for example, many years ago with Stacey Kuhn and the other police officers out there in Los Angeles. And it was successful, that prosecution, whereas the state had not been as successful before that. So Slager is facing a federal trial for criminal deprivation of civil rights and some firearms charges coming up. And I think there's a better chance that he'll be convicted at that trial. And then the prosecutor has to make a decision. Are they going to retry Slager? And if so, what charges? And they've already said, yes, they're going to retry Slager. But that's not always the case in this type of situation. We've seen it in a few instances recently, one in North Carolina just a few weeks ago, where the decision was made initially not to charge an officer. And we've seen it over and over again, where once there's been an unsuccessful prosecution, the state declines to re-prosecute the case. They don't try it again. They just figure they're not going to be able to get a conviction, and they drop it. And that's troubling. So I think it's important that we've got the federal charges pending. It's a little bit odd that the feds got out in front here and their case is ready to go to trial pretty soon now. Usually they wait until the state's failed to successfully prosecute. But I think that's a good thing, and that's exactly why that law's there.
And so for now, it's wait and see. The streets are calm.
I hope the streets are calm, but you know what? If it were a hot summertime now, I don't know that would be the case. But, cooler minds are prevailing at this point, and I think that's important. And it's really says a lot about the local community in North Charleston that they're able to hold it together, because these are not easy times for the people that live there and in other areas where across the country.
Phil, thanks so much.
Well, my pleasure.
Philip Simpson is associate professor at Bowling Green State University's Criminal Justice Program. The literal temperature out there at the Standing Rock Barricade is 3 degrees Fahrenheit, but the voices of protesters sound much warmer as it begins to sink into them that weeks of people power have become recognition by the U.S. government that the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has a legitimate land claim to territory under the Missouri River. The Dakota Access Pipeline that was planned to go underneath a dammed section of the river near the drinking water source of the Standing Rock Tribe will now be diverted. Dwali Saikautau is a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio.
The denial of the easement permit is only a temporary win, say some of the protesters and tribal leaders. Take a listen to one young activist, Tomas Lopez, with the International Indigenous Youth Council.
Once the new presidency and the new administration comes in, we'll have a whole nother fight. But for today, we're celebrating. We're celebrating that for the first time in U.S. history, the U.S. government is going to honor tribal sovereignty and the treaties that were signed on behalf of the tribes and the U.S. government. On a personal level, for the first time, I feel like we're being acknowledged as a people, and we're being seen, and we're being heard. And it's very empowering, and I'm very honored and happy that I can stand behind my people in this way.
A handful of journalists were selected to meet with some of the commanding officers and folks who are working along the police line north of the barricaded bridge. Take a listen to Sergeant Luke Hendrickson. He's with the North Dakota Highway Patrol stationed in Fargo.
I will say one thing for the protest side, for them to have assembled so many people and to be working for one cause, it is pretty impressive, because when they come out here, they do have an intention and they work towards getting that goal accomplished, and right now they have. So it is impressive in that respect.
That is Dwali Saikautau with Minnesota Public Radio. The company behind this now apparently diverted pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners, said they were still committed to ensuring that this vital project is brought to completion. That's a quote. Craig Stevens is a spokesperson for the Midwest Alliance for Infrastructure Now.
We hope this isn't the last word on the Dakota Access Pipeline, and we think that President-elect Trump in his comments yesterday from the transition seemed to indicate that they're going to take a serious look at it once he gets into office. And we certainly believe that this provides President-elect Trump the opportunity to demonstrate to the world that the U.S. is open for business, that there will be regulatory certainty for businesses and entrepreneurs who actually want to invest in America.
And the message, if that pipeline goes underneath the sacred burial lands of the Standing Rock Sioux, is that America is not open for business?
Well, I think the question here is whether that actually is what you say it is. As we've discussed, that this pipeline is actually co-located with a natural gas pipeline that already exists and has been there for more than 30 years. I actually went to the site and was told that many of those remains had been moved when that natural gas pipeline was there. So there certainly is, some concern by the Native American tribes, but also we have to make sure that we're working within a circumference of regulatory certainty whenever we look towards investment in the United States.
Now, if you were to tell me tomorrow that some land that we were looking at is actually sacred to you and your family is buried on it, I would that would settle the matter right there. I wouldn't be concerned about trying to dig up the remains and determine if they were actually yours or not. Why is this different?
Well, what if the FCC came in and said that for whatever reason we just don't like your show anymore and tried to strip your license for no apparent reason? I think that, again, we're looking towards – we live in a civil society that is governed by laws and regulations, that have been, you know, passed through Congress, signed by an executive, a president or a governor. And this is the circumstance we live in. And, you know, to change that without any real evidence is, I think, a real challenge.
Are you equating the Standing Rock Sioux with the FCC?
What I'm talking about here is regulatory certainty. And again, the regulatory certainty and the questions that were brought forth by the Assistant Secretary when she issued her memo, you know, it provides, I think, a chilling effect on infrastructure development because they really don't understand what to expect from the federal government. I mean, this project itself is 1,200 miles long, has been approved by four state governments and the federal government. And the federal government actually only has jurisdiction over 35 miles. And even this passage was already approved for the easement by the Army Corps of Engineers. And then when you have the Assistant Secretary of the Army saying that everything was done right, but we're going to go back and take a look at this, I mean, that's a real challenge.
How many millions of dollars has the company lost here?
Well, they've invested over $2.5 billion to this point. And certainly every day that there is a delay, it is costing the company money. And if there's a reroute, I mean, that will be a significant delay. We're talking months to years, depending on the actual path of the reroute. That's a significant amount of money for the company.
Does it really matter to the company where the pipeline goes, under this site or that site? I mean, oil is oil, gas is gas.
Well, the amount of time and effort that it will take to reroute, if you just look at this, the Dakota Access Pipeline, I mean, they've been at this for over 800 days. They've had to purchase easements. They've had to get cultural and environmental surveys completed and approved by the four state governments and by the federal government. So this is a huge investment already by the company. And to reroute would be, again, a significant amount of money and well into the billions.
Do you have kids, Craig?
I do.
What have they said to you about this? I mean, it's probably not terribly often that your job ends up as the headlines in the news,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, I think they're more concerned about, you know, my safety more than anything else. They certainly have an understanding of the facts, and which is, I think, what we've tried to present is the facts and the rule of law. You know, certainly the emotional side of this is something that the main coalition will never win, right? So that's why we have talked about the facts and made sure that people understood that this pipe does not cross reservation land, that there's actually right now a rail line that crosses within 2 miles of the Standing Rock Sioux's water intake that carries 300,000 barrels of oil a day. So there are real facts out there, I think, that are being missed by the American people.
Craig Stevens is a spokesperson for the Midwest Alliance for Infrastructure Now. Thanks so much, Craig.
Thanks for having me.
Something like the red carpet of maximum security prisons. ADX Florence, the supermax in Florence, Colorado. Convicted terrorists Terry Nichols, Zacharias Massawi, Ramzi Youssef, and Theodore Kaczynski, among others, spend their lives in this facility that, like most prisons, is being asked to address mental health issues as well as terrorism and crime. The main treatment, solitary confinement. At times, Jack Powers spent more than a decade in isolation at ADX, writing about his experience. The world outside is like another planet. I feel like I am trapped within a disease. I could recount scores of cases here in Colorado and many others around the country, but in this week's Case in Point, the Marshall Project's Andrew Cohen reports that a settlement in a class action lawsuit brought by a group of mentally ill prisoners against federal prison officials may be as much of a landmark as any decision in the last century. I spoke with Andrew Cohen from the Marshall Project and Dr. Terry Cooper's Institute Professor at the Wright Institute in Oakland and author of Solitary, Supermax Isolation, and the Future of Prison Rehabilitation, forthcoming from the University of California Press. Cooper says the culture of prisons is changing.
We have seen a massive growth in the population of prisoners with serious mental illness since the 1970s. And it's attached to deinstitutionalization, the downsizing or closing of mental hospitals, the war on drugs, because a lot of people with mental illness are also abusing substances, and a relative defunding of public mental health services. So people with serious mental illness fall through the cracks and eventually end up in the criminal justice system. Inside prison, they then selectively end up in solitary confinement.
Andrew Cohen, in the case that you describe here, this class action, first of all, how did it get to be a class action? And secondly, how did the individuals who are the plaintiffs here have the wherewithal to pull this off?
Ed Arrow, an attorney with Arnold Porter, was very actively involved in hearing about these cases. The prisoners themselves had been writing pro se complaints without the help of lawyers, trying to get relief, trying to get help from the Federal Bureau of Prisons. They were unsuccessful in doing so. And then somehow they were able to come together and, for the most part, stay together. Not all of the plaintiffs who initially were plaintiffs 5 years ago when the lawsuit was filed are still plaintiffs. Some have been released. Some have been given the sort of relief that they were hoping for. But obviously, it's a much bigger problem than just a handful of people. And part of the reason why we picked this story is because this is a solution. This is the federal government responding to litigation in a way that's pretty significant.
What are we on the verge of, do you think, in this case, in terms of changing the precedents for the use of solitary and all aspects of mental health and discipline in prisons?
This is a huge landmark case that has the potential to be, because what you're doing is you are beginning to change a culture within the Federal Bureau of Prisons that made fun of mentally ill prisoners, that derided them, that punished them for being mentally ill, that took away their medicine, and then when they invariably got worse, punished them, that allowed them to sit in their own filth and waste for days or weeks on end. That culture can't change in a day or a week, but this is the sort of settlement with oversight and with all sorts of accountability provisions built into it that could change Supermax. And if it changes Supermax, where the worst of the worst are housed, you would think eventually that's going to trickle down to all the many other federal facilities, some of which do a better job than others around the federal system dealing with mental health. Mental health in prisons and jails is an enormous issue in criminal justice, and this is basically the bell cow for the whole system.
We're talking with Andrew Cohen, commentary editor at the Marshall Project, and Dr. Carrie Coopers, institute professor at the Wright Institute in Oakland and author of Solitary, Supermax Isolation, and the Future of Prison Rehabilitation. This is The Takeaway. Dr. Coopers, is there an inmate, a particular character who might have at one time been a plaintiff in this lawsuit who believed in this case and has from the beginning, who you can actually focus an image of their face in your own mind about how much this means?
I can't name one, but what they're going to experience is removal from isolation, which was exacerbating their mental symptoms greatly. And then one hopes they will receive adequate mental health care in a setting that's more peaceful, and they'll be able to improve their condition significantly.
Back in the day, if you were mentally ill as a prisoner at this particular federal prison, and you were lucky enough to get a therapy session, you were taken out, you were surrounded by guards, you were shackled from behind, and you were allowed to talk to a therapist. There was no privacy. There was no privacy even from the guards. Other prisoners might be able to hear you. The idea that that was going to generate productive therapy that was going to help somebody with a mental illness was absurd. And that's going to go away, or should go away, if this settlement or when this settlement is approved. There's going to be these individual counseling rooms. There's going to be the ability to have a little modicum of privacy for these men when they do their therapy. That's just one small example of the change.
With so much talk about government not working, I want to thank both of you for just allowing me to have a conversation with two people who are observing the functionality of the judiciary. How good does this make you feel? And again, it's maybe a little premature that the people are responding correctly, appropriately, that this is moving forward as opposed to just being stalled.
This lawsuit now makes it mandatory that they be examined, that those with mental illness and those who are suicidal be given the treatment that their condition requires. That's going to improve the situation a lot. But as I said before, this is a special population, people with mental illness. The other prisoners are also being harmed by this. And though they might not be overtly psychotic or actually suicidal, there's a lot of self-harm going on. There's a lot of very high anxiety. There's a lot of very dysfunctional people in isolation. And what's needed is really to stop isolation altogether.
Final thoughts, Andrew Cohen?
The change in culture, the change in perception from the Justice Department and the Bureau of Prisons is a significant shift. And the big question for me going forward, regardless of how this deal or this case plays out, is that going to change with a new head of a Justice Department and perhaps a new head of the Bureau of Prisons going forward in the Trump administration? This deal will still be this deal if it's signed, right? The Trump administration can't go back on it. Jeff Sessions, if he's approved to be the head of the Justice Department, can't go back on it. But the culture that is shifting in one direction, it'll be interesting to see if that shift continues.
Andrew, Terry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Fire department workers are still searching the site of that deadly warehouse fire in Oakland, California, which consumed the Live Work building known as the Ghost Ship on Friday night, as the space was packed with people for a concert.
You don't understand how quickly this happened. I was asleep in the back where the fire broke out. I woke up to my room filled with smoke. I look out and I see this orange glow. And in the time it took me to get on these shoes and this jacket, I look out and there is a wall of fire. And I just headed for the door.
That was Carmen Brito talking to the East Bay Times. She said she lived in the ghost ship. So far, officials have found 36 bodies, making this Oakland's deadliest fire. Among the victims and the missing are musicians, artists, a teacher, and a high school student. The deadly fire raised questions about these types of warehouses where people, generally artists, are the seeds of new communities that attract high-income young people and entrepreneurs and also benefit real estate developers. The ghost ship was an artist haven, a labyrinth of sculptures and instruments, but also a dangerous space with makeshift stairs and hard-to-access exits, as former resident Shelley Mack told the East Bay Times.
The back stairway was blocked because all of the wires were run through there for upstairs and downstairs. And they ran across the stairway, wooden stairway underneath. So if you didn't live there and didn't know, or you were drunk, you could fall down the stairs.
In 2015, two people were killed in a similar fire in Oakland. Others have been shut down. Other buildings have been shut down for code violations. City inspectors have attempted to investigate the ghost ship itself, but couldn't gain entry to the building. It appears they had not been back before the fire. Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf sought to reassure local artists that the city would support them and keep them safe.
But the safety of the cultural community in Oakland has a more nuanced meaning. Oakland has to keep its residents safe, but we also have to keep safe this incredible creative energy that makes this the city that we love so much.
Cy Musiker is a reporter at KQED in Northern California.
While a police helicopter hovered above the burned-out warehouse right across the street, artists were holding an open house and raising funds for fire victims. Walter Craven owns Norton Factory Studios, a haven for 25 artists.
This is a tip jar for the bar, and we're going to donate every dollar to help out the people that were affected by the fire.
City records say the burned warehouse lacks sprinklers. Craven is proud to show off his safety features, but he says some of his landlord neighbors aren't so careful.
I think some artists know that the building's not up to code or it's not safe, but what other choices do they have? Where else can they go?
Scape Martinez is a graffiti artist with a studio at Norton. He says artists raising a fuss over inadequate heat or fire protection are just asking for a rent hike or an eviction notice.
I think if you're any kind of artist, at some point in life you have sacrificed safety for your passion.
For Oakland officials, the fire is a wake-up call. Councilman Noel Gallo says the city will have to find the money for more and tougher fire safety inspections.
We recognize that we should have been more assertive in the past, but now we'll expedite that action.
But some fear that well-intentioned crackdown could end up pushing out more artists. For The Takeaway, I'm Cy Musiker in Oakland.
Cy Musiker is a reporter for KQED in Northern California.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Today, if all goes as planned, death row inmate William Sally will be executed in the state of Georgia. He's been on death row for the murder of his father-in-law since 1990. Today is his scheduled execution day, and unless a stay is granted by the Supreme Court or the Georgia Parole Board, his execution will be Georgia's ninth of the year, a record for the state, where the modern death penalty began in the 1970s, and the most of any state this year. As in 23 previous cases, Rhonda Cook will be there. She is a staff writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, but her job is also to witness for the public one of the most awesome expressions of state power there is, the power to kill the condemned.
Well, it's a job like any reporter has. We're supposed to be witness to things that happen in our world and then recount them to the public. So mine just happens to be covering executions and, in many cases, witnessing them as well as a media witness.
How many is this?
If this one happens, this will be my 24th.
And have you ever had the opportunity to say, you know, not today, or I've got to take my kids to a game, or I've got to be somewhere else?
I did one time a few years ago tell the Georgia Press Association, which sets up the print media witnesses, that I needed a break and I needed to skip that one. But otherwise, I have not. My editors are wonderful. They would give me that option if I wanted it. They've offered it, and that's the only time I've ever declined was that one time.
How could you tell that you needed a break?
I just felt kind of sad, oppressed, and that was pretty much it. I just needed a break.
Do you have a particular orientation to capital punishment as a journalist?
None. I've practiced for so many decades not having an opinion that I don't, and I have seen and felt the experiences of people on both sides, and I can empathize with both sides. So it's safer for me just to sit on that fence, so to speak.
Is there a perception of your role in the execution room at the time of the execution, Rhonda?
Well, they know that there are media witnesses there. I don't know if they know which group is that group. We sit on the third of three pews. We're on the back row. And sometimes the condemned will look at us, and sometimes he won't. I use he because only one has been a woman, and she did look at everyone in the room. But I don't know if they realize who we are. They just see the people in the room.
But the way you're describing this is as systematically as you've witnessed all these, I suspect you have an archive of memory of every single one.
This is going to sound horrible, but I don't remember them. And that could be something that my mind does to me. I remember the first one. I remember when we executed Kelly Gissendaner, and it's not because of her gender. It was because of her final moments. She sang until she could sing no more. And those two stand out. I always have to go to my list to remind myself of their names. So this could be just a defense thing for me, but I tend to shut them out once I'm gone and done with the story.
Do you expect that this execution will go forward?
I do, because the courts have been so insistent about this is too late. You're bringing it too late. We can't hear it. Of course, you know, I don't know. What do I know? It's a case pending between the Georgia Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court. And obviously they don't confide in me. But so far, every single court has said it's too late.
And are you going to keep doing this?
I will do this until I am no longer a reporter and as long as they want me to.
Thank you so much, Rhonda.
You're welcome.
With the given name of Maggie Wander, of course this young woman would find her way to lead a community of rappers, singers, spoken word artists, and writers. She calls herself Dessa.
I haven't met a locked door yet that I couldn't beat on a chain around my neck. I keep my skeleton key.
Dessa says it was studying philosophy at the University of Minnesota that led her to the rap collective Doomtree, which she would later join and become the CEO of their independent record label. Dessa has three full-length albums and has published two books of poetry. This song is also a good name for Dessa herself these days, fully immersed with elbows and fists at the ready. It's called fighting fish.
Self-sourced, self-came, self-took island of converts to conquerors old school. We march them in converts, just armed with their own tools. While my knees feel flexed, while my joints hold steady. Mind sharks, bomb straight, trucks laced ready. I travel by kite, travel light, at touchdown, I swallow the dice. I make my own luck now.
Fighting Fish, the song that we just heard, I had written because I was sitting on a panel with a bunch of other musicians. Most of them were from the Midwest. And as much as I love the values that I gleaned from a childhood growing up in Minnesota, one of the things that I just don't love was this idea that the way that we value humility at the expense of ambition sometimes, to try to stand out, to be special, to try to do something exceptional is essentially a conceit. And we ought to sit down to another cup of like lukewarm coffee with one sugar, one cream.
So, you're singing really loud there, Dessa, you know?
Kind of.
So that is upsetting to you.
I understand why someone believing that they're special could be problematic. You know, that can lead to issues of superiority and exceptionalism. But at the same time, it's really hard to do something special unless you think that you might be capable of it. And so this idea that it's all kind of workaday, keep your head down, keep your nose to the grindstone, do your good work and then go to bed. I thought, but man, what about reaching? What about trying for something big and maybe unprecedented? Can I do it? I have absolutely no idea. Will I do it if I don't try? Definitely not.
A whip with no candle, a wheel with no axle, a ride with no saddle, no lift, then I'm dragging the kite. A blade with no handle, a brick for your window, I'm fine, but I'm single or dumb, and I'm the same on both sides.
Part of what you are doing is trying to tap into anger and a sense of outrage in the way things are organized in this society. And it seems that your audiences expect that in some ways.
You know, a little bit. For me, the sweet spot feels like it lives somewhere between beauty and anger and tenderness. You know, a different titration of those three ingredients constitutes most of the music and art that I'm interested in.
Yeah. Not too many musicians use titration to describe their work. What's your background?
I studied philosophy as an undergraduate. And then after that, I knew that I wanted to practice philosophy, but I wasn't sure how. So I ended up
still doesn't explain titration. That's chemistry.
I ended up as a medical technical writer for a while. But to be honest, I remember learning the word titration in my chem class in high school, and I really liked that idea. So I just tucked that one in my breast pocket, and I keep it for radio interviews just in case.
Yeah. You're a poet?
I am. Yeah, I am.
What about poetry allows you to speak again in a voice that, you know, is going to grab somebody and turn them around?
One of the strengths of poetry is its absolute potency. You know, it's been boiled for days or months or years so that most of the good stuff has absolutely no extraneous word. And that's exciting. But yeah, I do have a poem with me called Mercy. Want me to give it a go?
Sure.
To forgive is to summon your character, red-eyed and sober, and command it to behave against the current of your instinct, to reach up and take down your own flag. To forgive is to break the wishbone of a living bird who consents to the procedure and volunteers to stay awake to save on anesthesia. It is to make a snow angel in the sawdust beneath the bench where they are shaving down your pride. To arrive at mercy, you pass through a tiny wooden door whose polished knob is the head of a brass pin. You do not enter whole. You undo yourself, pass yourself in pieces to be reassembled on the other side. Your vertebrae go singly, to be rethreaded on the wire of your spine. The larger bones are first reduced by fire. It happens in the early morning hours, often in a sudden, soft collapse. It will happen when your lungs are empty and your heart is still between contractions, and you will feel a cracking, like a breaking paper dam. Some pain, then swift release. And there you'll have it, every grievance unspooling at your feet, shining like cassette tape. I don't know how many have done it and survived. They don't come back to say. But I have seen them through the keyhole, swaying, mute, serene, with folded hands and upturned faces like rag dolls assembled by the blind.
Why is there so little mercy in places like Syria?
Oh, man. I'm certainly no geopolitical expert, but I think we are quick to identify otherness. We're quick to jump to a quick tagline. We're romanced by that kind of saccharine soundbite.
Find the enemy.
Find the enemy, or when we talk about economic migrants versus refugees, the idea that people are somehow coming to take something away from us.
As a young woman rapper, do you seek identity with your audiences, encouraging them as young women to speak as powerfully as you do?
You know, trying to be an active role model to me feels like a great way to water down and ruin the whole thing. Like nobody's mom walks in and says, I think this person should be a role model. And then the daughter goes, yeah. I mean, the whole point is there's an edge. That's why you like something when you're 13 and 14. But for me, I think that the objective has been to be as honest and as true about the wins and about the losses, and to trust that that truth will resonate and do its own work. I don't have to have an agenda. The true stories will do that on their own.
Welcome to New York.
Thank you. I love it here.
Thanks, Tessa.
Thanks.
I'm good all day. I keep my edges clean.
Decades before there was a Throwback Thursday, producer and writer Norman Lear convened America's future by invoking its already outmoded past. White, intolerant, know-it-all, the breadwinner in the working class family depicted in All in the Family opened a window on Black America by depicting the nastiness of Archie Bunker, a white man, and the growing group of characters who dared to confront people like him.
Yeah, I figured I could do a lot for the people in this district.
Which people are you talking about?
Look, I know what you're thinking, Bunker, but I'm talking about all the people. Blacks, browns, yellows, and whites.
How come you put the whites last?
Through Lear's television shows like All in the Family and Maude, he was able to introduce a new candor. And eventually, he brought African-American characters to the screen. Sanford and Son, The Jeffersons, Good Times, starring Esther Rolle as Florida Evans.
When Esther Rolle was playing Florida on Maude, Maude's maid, we could see she was a star. And to determine whether there was a series in it, we introduced her husband on a couple of episodes of Maude, John Amos. And when we had the John Amos and Florida together, the network was saying, hey, there's a show there. So, of course, we knew we had the first African-American family on television. And that was exciting because it hadn't happened before, but ordinary in the sense that we were dealing with yet another family of a different skin color.
When you began the revolution in television that started with All in the Family, what did you think you were doing that would change American culture?
I didn't think I was doing anything. When I brought writers into a writing staff, I said, let's pay attention to our kids and our mates and our what was going on in the family. Let's all read a couple of newspapers a day, and we'll pick the subjects for the episode to episode based on what is current and by way of problems and difficulties that we faced, because I learned the hard way there was comedy in difficulty. And as a matter of fact, that's how, you get sparks by rubbing the sticks together. You don't get it by keeping them apart. We brought those problems into work, and we were dealing with what we were living as families.
When did you realize that All in the Family was a part of the weekly conversation in America among the middle class and the lower middle class? When did you realize that was going on?
When I read about it, or when journalists asked me about it. I was, we were all people seeking to make a living. I have six kids. I was growing a family and working my ass off to make a living. That's really, truly what I thought I was doing. I was excited about doing real life problems, dealing with real life problems with real life, if we were getting it right, real life characters. That's what we thought we were doing. We began to understand when we would read and be asked the questions by others that we were having some influence that we didn't set out with any expectation to get.
What do you think of the real acceleration of African-American characters and dramas and the extent to which the Underground Railroad, the cable revolution, the digital revolution has has propelled African-American history onto the screen, way beyond the work that you did, but in many ways started by the first steps that you took back with All in the Family.
Well, I love it. I mean, and I am so flattered when I hear Kenya Barris talk about his show, Black-ish, as, you know, following stuff that we were doing some years ago, or Carmichael. I think those shows are sensational.
What do you think of Hamilton and the dramas that have been launched by so much of this history that Americans never really talked about?
Well, I've only seen Hamilton four times so far.
Oh, God.
And I could see it a couple of nights a week. It's that enthralling and wonderful to me.
I mean, I saw Hamilton. I thought to myself, you know, this is really the way in which art takes history, takes what's happening right now, and makes it electrifying. And I mean, I think that's what you've been doing all of your career. And it really gives you hope about America, because there is such fascinating history for all of the pain and agony in this country. Do you feel a part of that Hamilton revolution when you look at that show and others like it?
The fact that I've been in the business, that I've hired actors, that I know about acting, that I know anything about it, is very secondary. I just plop into a chair and my attitude is, take me. Whatever the show I'm watching, you got me, take me. And Hamilton has taken me to the moon.
Does America understand its history, and that its history in many ways puts blacks and whites on a trajectory of inequality unless we decide to really confront it?
I don't think so, because I don't. We don't have leadership. We don't think enough of civics to make sure our kids are learning. We don't think as much as we used to of the arts and music and such. Those things that bring us together. The arts bring us together. Laughter brings us together. We share in common our citizenship. The fact that that Shonda Rhimes is a celebrity doesn't mean she isn't a citizen. And I've always admired, going back to the Gregory Pecks and Burt Lancasters and Paul Newmans of my life, I've admired those stars who have worked hard to share, to mix their celebrity with their citizenship and stand up for the things they believed in.
Norman Lear, thanks so much.
I couldn't have enjoyed it more. Thank you.
Legendary producer, director, and writer Norman Lear. Hard to believe he's 94 years old. We'll have more on our series on how difficult it is to reflect the real America on entertainment programs tomorrow.
This is Amber from Worcester, Massachusetts, and I would say if the girls on the TV show Girls were actually broke and scrimping to get by, then I might see myself in some of those characters. It's not really that confusing to understand how older generations have developed this idea that millennials are bratty and taken care of when we see Hannah Horvath doing nothing for work and still living in New York City.
Hi, my name is Annette. I am calling from Sacramento, California. I am a female who is Muslim, and they portray Muslim women as inferior, uneducated, submissive, abused, and covered in a black cloak, including a scarf, the hijab. Of course, it bothers me because I have four daughters.
You find yourself depicted in the characters you see on TV? From Colorado Springs, men seem to be dumbed down in family shows where women play a dominant role. It bothers me, and I want something else.
Hi, my name is Judy, and I live in Central Virginia, outside of Charlottesville. It would be nice to see mature, progressive women from diverse backgrounds in leading roles.
Hi, my name is Ashley Adams, and I'm calling from Salem, Oregon. I'm white, so I understand that there is a white bias in TV representation, but as a female, I'm often annoyed by the stereotyping of women and the narrow roles they're given to play, especially in terms of the financial situations of people and the struggles they have, and just what people are dealing with on a daily basis.
Reach out to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Huckaberry. This is The Takeaway.
Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.